I am sitting here across from one of my heroes. I got to tell you. Now, you probably hear this all the time, but I am sitting here across from Phil Donahue. And, you know, you don't seem to get older. I mean, you look exactly the same. I'm just going to totally I don't usually gush, all right? I really don't. But I remember, God, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, watching your show, and I wanted to be a talk show host. I wanted to run down the aisle with my microphone. What do you think? What do you think? What do you think? It's amazing now in, I guess Oprah has stolen your thunder, and then there have been many, many since then. But when you did it, no one was doing it, right? I mean, you were the first.
Yeah,
go ahead, brag about yourself. Come on. Do it.
Well, we were born in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
So celebrities were not available to us.
Right.
And we knew that if we had any chance of surviving at all, we had to rely on issues. So our first guest was Madeline Marie O'Hare, the atheist.
Okay.
Who got rid of prayer in public schools. Imagine.
Right.
Most hated woman in America.
Right.
There's no heaven, there's no hell. There's no God, there's no angels.
And she said that on your first show.
Uh-huh, and the building fell in.
I was just going to say, weren't you canceled the next day?
The entire city of Dayton came to a halt. People wouldn't leave the barbershop after they got the haircut. We entered screaming, as you might imagine. We had a management that held on against all the
people
who were
ready. How the heck did you get one of those in today's
age?
Well,
first of all, freedom's just another word for, you know, we were so small. You know, if we had started on the network, we'd have died in the first week. But we were syndicated, you know, and that's a more honest way. Every market that carried the Donahue Show made a decision to buy it. We weren't on a network. On a network, a vice president can end your career while he's shaving in the morning.
Right.
If I got canceled in Peoria, you know, we were still on in Indianapolis.
Now, tell me this. Obviously, your political views are now well known. You are very much opposed to the Iraq War. We're going to get to your documentary in just a second. Even when you were on MSNBC for however long that lasted, your views were well known. At least when I started watching you, and I was just a kid, but I don't think we knew your views. Do you think on your talk show you allowed your views to come through? Or
over the time, I did. I mean, you can't do. We did over 6,000 hours. You know, you can't walk down the center of every issue like a robotic tin man, never revealing how you feel.
And as you were running down the aisles. You were no robotic tin man.
I love that,
you know, with the microphone in hand. I got to ask, did you ever trip?
Oh, sure.
Because you just sprint down those aisles.
In the early days, we didn't have wireless mics. In 1967.
Oh, my God.
I'm an analog guy in a digital world today.
Right.
And so I had a cord.
Uh-huh.
And I used to rush to the back row, you know, because somebody had their
hand. Right,
right.
You would run. You'd sprint. And that was part of your charm, actually.
And strangle three people in the front row. So when we finally got the wireless, you know, then life became a little easier. But over the years, I guess I began to lean. I always leaned left. I mean, I could, you know, I...
Why is that? Are you from Dayton, Ohio? Where are you from?
I'm from Cleveland. I was born and raised in Cleveland.
All right. Kucinichville.
Uh-huh. In fact, I went to high school at St. Edward High School, which is in his district.
Here I am. Okay, I normally wouldn't call you on it. My other guests, I wouldn't. But here I am with the most professional guy in the entire industry, a guy that's been playing with microphones at least since 1967, and he's fiddling with this microphone, sitting on our stand, thinking
noise.
It's not going to cause. That's what you heard, my friends. Now, I don't call on my other guests who do this, but Phil Donahue should know better.
But these mics have wires.
I know, they're old-fashioned, aren't they?
You got to join the new world here, Mark. It's true. I you know, just absentmindedly grab it, and that goes
out
in the air, and I apologize.
I play with things, too. Hey, tell me, you're from Cleveland. You say you've always leaned left. Is that your parents? Are they from a union family? Where does this come from?
I am. I'm from my father was a furniture salesman.
Okay. So was Barack Obama's grandfather. Do you know that?
No, really?
Yeah. His grandfather, the one from Kansas, was a furniture salesman.
I worked at Republic Steel in Canton, Ohio. And
you worked in a steel factory?
Uh-huh.
Did you do assembly line stuff?
I was a mason's helper.
What does that mean?
That means I handed bricks to the guys who relined the open hearth furnaces. So
was that hot? I mean, did you burn your hands?
You'd be in for you could only go for 2 minutes and then you were out, or three, I forget.
Really?
But, you know, your blue jeans would hurt when your blue jeans touched your skin. I mean, that's how hot it was in there.
Oh, my God.
Of course, it was dry. But, you know, I don't want to overstate this. I mean, nobody came near death.
Well, we all had
hardly the most.
My
today,
great-grandparents worked in the sweatshops, too.
Right.
Was the union stronger? When was this? I'm going to go to your age. 50, 60?
Summer of 1955.
Summer
junior
of
four 19, or five.
No, summer of 1954 or five.
My junior senior year at Notre Dame.
The idea, sort of a historian, I wasn't around then, but the idea is that unions were a lot stronger
absolutely
in the 1950s
so
than today. That's true.
Oh, yes.
Okay, but here you are working where if you
by
touch
the way,
your
we
jeans,
had a strike while I was there.
Did you really?
Yeah,
over
I was
working
on
conditions?
Strike.
Or
I forget, you know, I'm ashamed of myself. It must have been wages. I assume it was wages.
Don't play with that cord. I'm watching you.
I made 300 and I made, I think the pay was 350 an hour, which was big time.
That's a lot, yeah. I mean, our minimum wage today isn't much better.
Yeah,
than
yeah.
That.
I think
sad
that
to
was
say
the wage. I hope I'm right. Somebody's going to do the Google here and
so
prove
the
me
union,
wrong.
The unions were there helping you with working conditions, with wages.
I was a member. You couldn't work there without being a member of the United Steelworkers of America, and I was.
Phil Donahue, what's happened to our unions? Be honest here.
Well, first of all, let me say I've never crossed a picket line, and if you think I'm bragging, I am.
Good.
When the NBC technicians went on strike, we took our program to Stamford, Connecticut. I had the power then.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, the show was hot.
Right.
And I said, I'm not crossing this line.
Right.
Off we went to Stamford. Isn't it a shame? I mean,
is it because manufacturing has gone down? Is it harder to unionize
because,
the service industry?
It's because management has all the power and all the money.
Okay, but they had all the power 100 years ago in the progressive era when we started. What's the difference today?
They somehow, you know, I think we've got people out there who so desperately need the job, they just don't have time for the organizing.
Didn't we have that in the 1950s? What was the difference?
I guess so.
Is it the immigrants coming across the border?
And the and my parents lived through the 30s. I mean,
right,
labor
Great
people
Depression
got their head beat over.
Sure, sure.
Sometimes by the cops.
Sure.
I mean, this was a brutal time. And all this pain and bloodshed that gave birth to this fabulous thing called the labor movement that put labor on the, you know, gave them some clout at the bargaining table, has been largely wasted and dissipated over the years. This is, you know, how about
we both recognize the problem. Tell me why do you think it is?
I think that management has successfully frightened workers into the belief that they won't have a job if they promote union organizing. And you're right, this isn't new. But I think it's more effective today. I also think as each year goes by, fewer and fewer young people appreciate the important role played by organized labor. It's just not a part of our public education.
Now, your father was in a union?
No, my father was a salesman, a retail furniture salesman.
That's right, the retail furniture salesman.
My grandfather worked for the city transit in Cleveland.
It's just interesting. You're from Ohio. When I think of Ohio, I think of a longtime union culture
I
don't think of.
And it was. Cleveland was when I was a kid. Cleveland at Dayton, Ohio, at Five Notre Dame, that's my alma mater, had five General Motors plants. Dayton, Ohio had five General Motors plants when I began my program in 1967, and they were all unionized.
Speaking of your alma mater, it's interesting to me that, you know, your very first show, you had an atheist on the air.
Right.
And you probably were on the air at a time when, I don't know, Catholics were not sort of out as Catholic as much. I mean, it's hard to think today that that's the case because it's I think a much. Did you get in trouble with your church or with people when you would promote, you know, things like atheists or?
Sure, we did our first pedophilia, and pedophilia show.
When?
86.
That's very early.
You know, with my mother watching at her, in her apartment in Cleveland.
Did your mother get mad at you?
You know, she didn't say anything, but she had to be hurt, you know.
Because she so believed in that church.
Oh, sure. I mean, my mother was a good Catholic girl from West Cleveland. Here's her son talking, and the guy was from the New Orleans Times Picayune. His name is Jason Berry. He did the best work, early work on the, he said, this is the church's Watergate.
Well, here's
and
my
nobody
question.
Believed him.
Why isn't it good? Why isn't it good as a Catholic to expose
Amazing.
Pedophilia?
Because we haven't been able to speak and to really criticize effectively this church. It has become a top-down, totally closed institution.
Hasn't it always been that way?
Yeah, but, you know, the stakes are larger now. The church is telling third world men that they shouldn't wear condoms in an age of AIDS.
Right.
That's a mortal sin. Stop this. And what have we heard, really, from the Pope has said he's against this war. Oh, well, thank you, Your Holiness. Let's have a little more force here. Let's say it more often.
Should
what
he excommunicate some of these people?
I see excommunication as a kind of medieval, anachronistic.
Okay. Speak out more strongly.
Right. And
should he say Rumsfeld has blood in his hands or something like that? I don't see the Pope saying things like
no,
that.
No, I don't. But he should be louder and more forceful. We still have a church deciding about who's a saint. I have evolved to a place where I'm with Tennyson.
Lord Tennyson.
Oh, there lives more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds.
I love that.
Isn't that bad?
I love that. Listen, I've got to give you a chance to promote your documentary. Although, I tell you, I could talk with you for hours. I would love, I don't know if I get the commitment right here, folks. I'd love to have you on my show for a full hour sometime.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I'd like to be there. Really would. Especially if you let me sell my movie.
I will let you sell your movie. Tell me about it.
My movie is titled Body of War. We have a website, bodyofwar.com. This is a movie that I financed, have produced, and I've co-directed with
your
a wonderful filmmaker by the name of Ellen Spiro. So, I mean, you can't make a movie by yourself. I ought to know. And I got myself a fabulous camera person to bring in. Just, I couldn't believe what
and
she was bringing.
And the story of a wounded vet. I mean, he's the hero or
he is.
Of your story.
He signed up 9/13, wanted to get the evildoer, saw the president on
I
the
pile.
I have
friends that did that.
And this is a bright young man. This is a young man with insight. He's a Heartland kid, Kansas City, Missouri.
What happened to him?
He's in Iraq 5 days, open top.
5 days.
Mm-hmm, open top truck going down Main Street, Sadr City, and from a rooftop, the bullet came through his shoulder blade and exited T4. That's between the shoulder blades.
It's one
and
of the spinal cords.
He is paralyzed from the nipples down.
Wow.
Thomas can't talk. Thomas can't cough. His stomach muscles are paralyzed. Thomas has morning nausea. Thomas he throws up every morning.
How does he communicate?
He can talk. He can't walk.
Oh, he can't walk.
He has arms,
right,
and speech and
right.
head movement.
Okay.
He has nothing below the nipples. And the closer you get to him, erectile dysfunction, 27 years old, the more you're just blown back by the gravity of this injury. His urinary tract infection, because he has to be cathetered, and if the urine stays in the urethra, then it crystallizes, causes...
How does someone like him, who joined in the patriotic fervor after September 11th, and then was sent not to Afghanistan, the war that most of us felt was at least a justified war,
mm-hmm.
and sent to a country that never attacked us. And
right.
did he not want to go? Did he believe in it at the time and become disillusioned?
He did. He believed in it
in Iraq.
But no, not in Iraq.
Oh, in Afghanistan.
When he signed up.
Right, he believed in Afghanistan.
He hit the light bulb went on at Fort Hood during basic. He said, you know, what am I doing here? Iraq. And he was.
They didn't attack us.
They had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right.
And why are we going here?
Right.
But it was a little too late. He's in now. And he goes there, and he's there 5 days, and he's going down Main Street, Sadr City. He is transferred to Landstuhl, then to Walter Reed, where I met him, and then to St. Louis Rehab, and then home. By the way, he meets Bobby Mueller in our film.
Really?
Bobby Mueller.
I just saw Bobby Mueller. In fact, he's the director of the FBI. I saw him in a hearing.
No. This is
a
different Mueller.
Oh, you're talking about different Mueller. Yeah. Excuse me. I'm talking about the FBI director. That's Robert Mueller. I thought you were talking about
Bobby Mueller.
Who's Bobby Mueller?
Bobby Mueller is a Vietnam veteran who's been in a wheelchair for 38 years.
Oh, my God.
Having sustained the same bullet wound that Thomas had, the subject of my film.
Wow.
So Thomas rolls into Bobby Mueller's apartment. And they talk, and we film this.
Right.
And Bobby said, how long were you in the hospital, Thomas? And Thomas said, counts on his fingers, he said, over the course, about 3.5-4 months. And Bobby stares at him, and there's a long, long pause in our movie. You see this. And he looks at Thomas. He said, Thomas, I was in the hospital for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on an outpatient basis for another 9 months. you got short shrift, man. I mean, this is Bobby Mueller, who calls himself a gimp. Yeah. And Thomas says, oh, enough, somebody else who says gimp, you know. And you have the old gimp kind of instructing the new gimp on what his life's going to be like.
Well, I saw some of these in the Doonesbury cartoons. I'll tell you, Phil, again, I'd love to talk with you for a full hour. Right. Your publicity person is insisting I leave, and I don't want to. I want to talk with you more. But tell me, your film's opening in D.C., Washington.
It's opening in D.C. on April 4th.
April 4th. Where
at the E Street Theater in D.C.
E Street Theater. All right, I know it well.
And then we go to New York, April 9th.
Okay.
Then to Boston. And we're going to San Francisco.
And eventually people, wherever they live, will be able to get it on some DVD.
You know,
DVD
we're out there
something.
Proving our attractability here. You know, we have to prove we can sell tickets, and we think we can. We think our movie is different.
Phil Donahue, it is such a pleasure and an honor to have
you
here on the Inside Scoop, and I want to have you back. All
I'm
right?
I'm looking for you at the opening back. Now.
I'll be there.
Right.
I'll be there. Mark. Thanks again.
Thank you.